Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio. For this episode, The Gateway is excited to welcome Pete Paschal, the founder and CEO of The Media Copilot, a newsletter and podcast about how generative AI is changing the media. He also teaches creative professionals in journalism and PR about how to use AI tools, and he consults with companies of all sizes on how to incorporate generative AI into real work. Pete has a long career in journalism, previously holding senior roles in global newsrooms such as CoinDesk and Mashable. As a thought leader in tech, crypto, and AI, he often appears on TV news, including appearances on Fox Business, CNN, and The Today Show. He also puts his encyclopedic knowledge of Doctor Who to good use in his side hustle, the popular podcast, Pull to Open. Pete, welcome to The Gateway. It is a pleasure to have you today.
Thanks, Russ. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
We are excited as always. And when we were able to connect, I thought your background, your experiences really fit well with the plethora of people that we talk to. So I'm really excited that you're here and going to go through this. But I always like to start these episodes at the beginning. And so I want to kind of know, how'd you get to where you are today? Give us a background.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. So I had a long career, and arguably still have a long career in tech journalism. So when I moved to New York to start a career in media way at the long ago, shall we say, but sort of at the beginning of the 21st century. And I sort of landed in tech media when tech was really more about man caves and surround sound. And that sort of became iPhones, which became social networks, et cetera. And I moved around to a bunch of places. I've worked at NBC. I was the tech editor of Mashable for a long time. I worked at PC Mag. It's been a super exciting ride, working in media in New York. And then I went to CoinDesk for a while to check out crypto world. But while I was at CoinDesk, this thing called AI burst onto the scene, right? And yep. It's not like I wasn't familiar with AI. Obviously, I'd covered Google, I'd covered Siri, I covered what sort of passed for AI for the longest time. But this was something new. When ChatGPT came out, it was like, oh, wow, this is huge. This is going right to alter, like, you know, not just media, but like knowledge work in general. And that's certainly been the case since it happened. So it was pretty soon after that day, I tried to figure out with the team at CoinDesk what our approach to AI was going to be, and ended up leading a committee there and writing some guidelines and then starting to sort of prototype some use cases. And it was all super exciting stuff. But there wasn't really a desire to invest because, you know, crypto was not doing super great at the time, partly because of CoinDesk. By the way, their reporting brought down FTX and SBF, so that was a very
those are a couple of good feathers on the journalism side of the,
but yeah, kind of a little suicidal if you think about it. Right. But you know, good for the integrity. And so when I found myself, looking for a job after they had a series of layoffs, or not really looking for a job, but thinking about my next move, I realized, well, you know what I want to do? I want to lean into the things I know best, which is AI and media. And I certainly just dove in headfirst when I decided to do that. I didn't really even put a whole lot of thought into what I was doing. I just said, I'm going to launch a Substack and start writing a newsletter and teach myself this stuff and pass on what I know. And after that, first of all, the response was great, not just from my sort of friends in the media, but like the media and folks who subscribed in general. And pretty quickly after that, someone reached out to me and was like, hey, man, can you come into my office and teach me about this AI stuff? that was literally the note. And I kind of was like, yeah, sure. And so I went to this contact in the city. I taught their team how to use AI, what prompting was, et cetera. And that went super well. I thought, this could be a thing I do. And earlier this year in January, I started actually just offering formally courses and one-off classes about
Wow.
AI to creative teams. And now I've done so many of those and evolved that class and offered several others. That's really the primary thing I do now. Now I still do the newsletter because that's the way I sort of speak
Yeah.
to the world. But a big sort of AI teaching consultancy has sort of emerged out of, well, big. It's me and some people, a few people that help. It's not, but for me it's big. And it's been sort of an exciting journey ever since, and certainly nonstop and sort of breakneck at the pace that AI is coming at us now.
Right. Well, I absolutely love that story because it shows so many different paths to get to where maybe I'm speaking for you a little bit here, Pete, but like to a location that maybe you never even envisioned you'd end up there. And especially coming from a journalism and what I'm going to identify in this conversation is more of a softer skill background, more of your communications, more of your arts, your humanities, and then going into kind of more of the harder skills of
Sure.
programming, AI, technology, all of that stuff. I like your experience with the blend of those two, because I think so many times, at least for college students or people that are looking at changing careers, it's a lot of times one or the other. And now AI, especially with ChatGPT, is literally the mix of those two of how do we use tech and our humanities to do knowledge work better. Was that something that you had to get accustomed to, and like, did you have to learn the language of tech to be a useful journalist, someone that can report on that, or was it something that you just kind of dove into and then figured it out as you went?
Yeah, I think probably certainly my tech background helped a lot. And it's in sort of a previous life to even my media career. I actually got an engineering degree
I
way back
see.
in the 90s, which I always joke never used. But the combination of those things, the fact that I sort of have this very left brain problem solving, make things make sense and be technical. Background plus having covered tech for so long, I think I sort of figured out what the sort of strengths, weaknesses, and what AI could offer me in society pretty quickly, like probably faster than others. Because the whole idea, for example, of like hallucinations, like, oh, I sort of understand like the probabilistic nature of the software versus how traditional software is deterministic. And why this is sort of an inherent problem with generative systems. And I think most people sort of think of it as, oh, it just makes stuff up sometimes. And that's sort of a bug, which is true, but not an incomplete answer. It's kind of an incomplete answer. So I think it gives me a certain amount of help, or at least an advantage in sort of how to think about these things. With tech in particular, and sort of knowing a lot of the people who, not knowing them personally, but knowing the players involved in making tech, your Metas, your Googles, OpenAI certainly, and all the others, and Apple, which I'm very familiar with, having covered them very closely at Mashable, sort of understanding all that and the things that motivate those companies and their customers, that's also been a good thing to have in terms of like where to look next, who do I think is going to be offering the better product to do a particular thing. Although I will say this, the tech world has managed to surprise me a few times in this past year. I mean, not just with the rapid pace of AI, but who would have thought that Meta was going to be a hardware leader in this kind of stuff, right? With
Right.
the
Yeah.
Ray-Bans and now this new sort of Orion glasses, just a prototype now, but those look really sci-fi, really cool.
I found Meta's branding with Ray-Ban and putting in that technology to be probably one of the
smartest or even reflective back to like new Apple, like when they were coming out, like that felt kind of close to that, that I was like, oh, you got it. Stop putting this cool technology in really weird things that no one wants to do. They're like, oh, here's an already established brand. We can kind of do that. And I think that will blend it. This is an opinion question, Pete. So I know there's no right answer with this one, but do you think we'll get to a point as society that wearable technology other than a remote, but something that we actually have on our face and does overlays, the AR, whatever, the augmented reality, do you think we'll get to a point that we'll be comfortable with that, or will it be the Google Glass backlash every single time?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think Google Glass failed not because of the technology per se. I think there was a social component that was kind of impossible to get over. But because we've both had glass and also had 15 plus years of people just kind of walking around with cameras in their pockets, and not just cameras, but devices that are arguably recording you all the time, I think society has kind of moved to a point where there's almost an expectation that your privacy is being violated all the time, that you just sort of can't hide from the technology. And I think if Google Glass were released today, I think there's still problems with the design and the ways they executed it, but I don't know if we're having quite the same reaction. You're kind of seeing that with the Ray-Bans. So there were some pretty specific reasons I think Google Glass failed. But now that sort of there's also not really much in the way of apparent benefits from having it around, right? Whereas with stuff like AI and being able to have sort of queries answered very, very quickly, I think that is that's a clear thing that, oh yeah, I just kind of want that. You know, I want, you know, my robot companion to be in my glasses, looking at things, listening to the same things I am, and then giving me feedback that's helpful either visually or audibly. The one thing that I think is going to take a while for people to get used to, as good as those Orion glasses look, and they also have that sort of wrist sort of control thingy, is that we're used to touching things, whether it's a keyboard or a screen, and in just our use of technology, that has with it a certain amount of precision. You know, like we can point or click at the exact sort of pixel or button that we want. And I've used like the Apple Vision Pro and various other things, and they're still not like, you're still kind of like doing this, and like, you know, I'm holding up my hand here for people just listening, and like you're kind of like, I can't quite do it. You kind of need to get used to it. And I think that sort of tactile learning curve is still kind of an issue, but I think it's less of an issue for people growing up with this technology. So I think within a generation or even half a generation, I think there's a chance things like the Orion glasses and these heads up displays or whatever you want to call them could become the next thing, like the thing that you know, passes the phone. Not that phones are going to go away entirely, but it's like, you know, a Google engineer once told me that everyone's input and output are on their head, right? So it just kind of makes sense that would end up being where you put the head, tech.
Yeah, from it's an, all like, the ergonomic. Yeah, it's all right, you know? There. Okay.
Which kind of makes sense on a fundamental level. I kind of get it. But like the hands, I mean, there's a reason eye-hand coordination is a thing, right? So I think, like I say, we're not going to entirely get away from touching screens and clicking things, but you need a certain level of precision with this technology. Because, you know, like if you're not touching a thing, like, you know, we've all tried these gesture interfaces and they're kind of cool for a demo, but they often get to a point where you're just like, I want a screen. I want to touch something so I know what I'm touching.
Sometimes I go, I want a keyboard.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I sometimes get long emails. I think most people are this. You get a long email on your phone and you realize I should just type out that response, so I'm not going to reply until I'm in front of my computer.
Yeah. Right. I have another opinion question. So you mentioned new generations growing up with this, and they have less of an issue adopting these less traditional devices, especially wearables. But do you think So technology is getting much, much easier to use. Think about Windows 95 and where we are with interfaces today. Everyone is moving towards making using their tech intuitive because they have a financial incentive to do so. Do you think that will cause the new generation not to be less tech savvy, quote unquote, or like if an interface is not perfect, they will struggle using it? Because I have encountered students that asked me, how do I print this? And they were talking about the print button on the Adobe Reader. Because they're just used to so intuitive interfaces, especially from, you know, iPhone and Apple.
Yeah, I think what you, well, sort of almost separate from that, you've highlighted a big failure of the printer industry. Now, that said, simply the need to print is a lot less needed today, right? Like, I always sort of give my wife a little side eye whenever she wants. Like, we share an office here, and she's printing stuff with him, doing things. And I'm just like, do you really need to print that? Do you? Couldn't you have just sort of emailed it to the person or whatever? But the convenience of a user interface is kind of a, it's almost like you got to take a step back from the technical stuff. And it's really just people want friction removed from themselves and the information they want to get to or the thing they want to do, right? And this is really a big thing that AI does. It's all, it's another friction remover. Good example is AI powered search, which is it just gives you an answer, right? You go to Perplexity or now the ChatGPT search engine, and it's like, oh, I don't want to sift through the 20 links it comes at me with and then process that with myself. I like, you do it, AI, and just give me the answer. And to your point, sometimes the answer is wrong, or sometimes the answer just doesn't have all the information you want. In fact, I was just writing about this with ChatGPT. You know it's not going to have all the information you want because you know, a regular web search would give me the New York Times for certain answers, and ChatGPT can't do that because the Times is suing them and other publishers are blocking them. So, but the removal of that friction, maybe I'm okay with that, you know, and this whole idea of the information might be incomplete. In fact, some of the information might be wrong. There's a certain level of people thinking, and I think this is more about young people just going, it was super convenient, so I'll take it. And
so just accept the risk.
I'm also just going to kind of live in this world where convenience is the most important thing. And I'm willing to deal with a little more ambiguity and issues in the underlying thing it comes at me with, right? Like, you know, this is why like AI hallucinates, yet we haven't stopped using it. We just have adjusted our expectations. Like, oh, we just, you know, I'm not necessarily going to fact check everything, but I am going to be like, I get it. It's generally right, but some of the details are wrong. And that's how I think people just regard AI now. And it's still super popular. It's not like people, everyone junked ChatGPT just because it made up stuff every now and then.
Right. Well, and Pete, it goes back to even what you were saying about the assumed insecurity or privacy violations. That is like, you want to use these things. You're like, yeah, we're going to track absolutely everything you do with that. And we're going to know all of that. And you're like, again, all these generate, we just accept that as part of the convenience factor,
ChatGPT is arguably worse, right? Because if you don't turn on privacy, it's not just tracking your every move. It might show your every move to somebody else just randomly because it regurgitates it. I mean, again, I think they've tuned it to the point that that's probably really, really rare now, but it's still possible.
Right. Well, and it then goes into that question of, okay, so if convenience is the most important thing, and there's a company that can give us an answer that, let's even say 75% of the time is what you need it to be, are we then almost elevating expertise, or maybe that's even the wrong term, completely removing the importance of expertise as a human, because 75% of the time I get the information I need from ChatGPT and Sam Altman's crews and I'm good to go. And like, but, and I bring up his name specifically because it, sometimes we forget that there's a human associated with this, and they have their own motives, they have their own stocks, they have their own profitability that they're worrying about. Like, at what point does that then get potentially corrupted? Because you're like, well, when you ask for what's the best cup of coffee, it's sponsored by Dunkin' Donuts. Hey, for real, Dunkin' Donuts, if you want to sponsor this podcast, we will gladly do that. But like, very quickly, I know that that's an objective question, but when does that also come into, now we're getting these answers and a sponsorship recommendation comes along with that without even knowing about it? Like, where do we then lose that humanity or that essence to be able to figure that out? I don't have an answer, and I don't even know if that was a question, Pete. So just, you know, deal with it. Sorry.
Yeah, I could deal with it. So I could deal with the commercial question first, which is a really good one, because we haven't quite seen it yet in a lot of these AI engines, but certainly ad models are coming. In fact, Google, with its AI overviews, Google's like the ad empire of the web, right?
Right.
They are already starting to put ad strips into their AI overviews, which is, of course, the answer they give at the end of searches and some of the searches now. That was totally expected. Perplexity has announced they're going to have ads. I have no doubt ChatGPT at some point is going to have ads in it. They've got, I think, enough funding at this point that they could probably let others do that first. But that's happening. Now, what effect that has on users is a really good wrinkle here, because I think people are very distrustful of commercial relationships in the information they get. I know this as a journalist, because whenever I would write about some Apple thing and was overly critical, all the Apple fanboys would say, hey, look, you had Microsoft advertising on your website. You're a Microsoft shill or whatever, you know, a Meta shill or whatever, you know, whatever the competitor was at the time on the particular thing I was talking about. And that's real, you know, like, and I don't know how many people stopped reading Mashable or whatever because of that, but, the existence of a commercial relationship does change the relationship with your users. So it's not to say don't do it, and there are certainly good and ethical ways to do it. Certainly at every media organization I've had, there was always a church state separation where I worked, so that like I had no idea how the ad business worked and who was advertising at any particular time. I had to look at the website just like anybody else. I think most people kind of know that in, if they're at all media savvy, but it doesn't stop them from making the accusation. So you just kind of have to be aware of that, and, you know, set up your system such that it you're transparent about your ethics. And so this is super important, because what I was talking about, the convenience, that's really on the user side. It's really how you're going to solve problems for the user and offer a good product is removing friction. But if you have that same attitude in designing the product, or this sort of lack of precision in what you're doing with the information you're trying to give them, that's not good. That's going to really wreck your trust. And so you started the question by asking about sort of like the expertise and whether that's going away. I don't think so, because at the end of the day, there's a human at the beginning, at the end of all of these interactions. AI is disintermediating. AI is taking all this collective knowledge from humans and turning it into something processed and serving that up to other humans. And there's a lot of complexities in that path. But it's ultimately humans at both ends. So the human generating the information needs to be an expert and know what they're talking about. And it needs to be presented in a way that a human really wants to read. This is honestly what I would say all the time to people. I used to train people on SEO, which obviously was a huge, huge thing. It still is a huge thing, but it was definitely a huge thing in digital media. And I would always say, always remember the person at the end of the search is a human. Yes, we're doing stuff for the bot so that we get on the front page of Google, but the human's the one who's clicking. So if you just, like, in SEO, this manifests as, you, if you just load a bunch of keywords in a headline, just one after the other, that's fine. You might get on front page of Google, but no one's going to click on that.
Right.
You know, people will click on the next link. That's a really compelling, you know, headline that's like, hey, you know, you will not believe what happened next after this woman rolled her stroller into the whatever, you know, or whatever it is, right? That was the Upworthy stuff for a while.
So
it's kind of like, the point is, like, it's got to be human driven. And if people designing these systems continue to understand that and work at the parts of the technology that don't work for humans, and hallucinations is a big one, I think that you can have good outcomes regardless of the commercial model.
Well, and Pete, you have an interesting perspective. That's why we bring you on. That makes sense. But oh, I think as sense. Right, exactly. As someone who, from what I'm gathering, and I might be speaking incorrectly here, but has a longer understanding on the different transitions during journalism from. I think we all have an understanding of what the periodical, you know, way back 1920s and
I started my career in magazines.
Okay.
When I was doing stuff at the campus newspaper where I went to school, the University of Alberta, we were still using line tape on photos. I'm dating myself here, but yes, I can speak to transitions in journalism, certainly.
Right, right. So you've experienced that one. What I'm finding interesting, and you're a perfect example of this, Pete, is that some of these journalists and even, I'm going to bring it down just
you
to
said that like it's in quotes.
Right, exactly. Well, because I meant like I was going to go with like overall corporations like Mashable, like a lot of the 404 media, like these larger still conglomerates that are basically websites, but there are versions of newspapers now that kind of fit into an area of niche. But it's even getting smaller that I definitely don't have to follow a specific media website. Follow your newsletter, your e-blast, specifically written from Pete, and I want Pete's opinion, and I trust his journalism, and I trust his work and his opinions, all of those things, and that's where I'm going to go from. So the individual journalist is almost becoming its private entity, its own thing, where it was always, or my experience with it was, the journalist was given validity by the paper or by the periodical that was printing it. Yeah. And at times, if the relationship got really well, the journalist also then gave validity to that paper, and it was kind of a symbiotic relationship, where now it's literally cut off and you're like, no, I'm going to write what I want to write about where I want to go, and I want to give it to my people, and they're going to pay for it and do a Patreon. Like, your own company is you in that way. Has that been your experience? And do you think that's a good thing to continue doing, that model from a shared human knowledge experience, I guess?
Yeah, so a lot to unpack there. One thing is that an indisputable trend that going it alone these days is sort of aspirational thing for a lot of journalists. It's very attractive. A lot of people are doing it. I'm arguably a part of this trend. I had a weird zigzag to get there. I sometimes wonder how quickly my company would have gotten an audience or my newsletter if I had done this right after Mashable, when I was a little more out there and writing more regularly.
Are you saying that it might have been easier?
Might have been a little easier. And then, because when I was at CoinDesk, I was in a strategic role. I did write a little bit, but I was mostly, in charge of strategy, things like newsletters, AI, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
And so what I did this years later, I think I probably had a slower start, because the general pattern in what you're talking about is exactly what you said. You know, as a journalist, you might have some raw talent, a publication hires you, you hone that talent, you build up a body of work and a beat with them over years, and it's sort of this mutual exchange that your brand builds, but you sort of springboard off the publications brand that you're associated with. And it's all very symbiotic until you get too big, right? And then it's like, well, and or you're too constrained by the, or, you know, not, this isn't the case for everyone, but you might feel that way. And then there's a great path today in previous eras, you would have to either become like an author or just jump ship and go somewhere else. And people certainly still do that. But now you can, there's the third way of essentially, okay, I can do my own thing, launch my own Substack or Patreon or what have you, your podcast. And then you could be more successful on your own depending on what path you take. I would not recommend people do that fresh out of journalism school, or certainly not as their first move in media. So you could maybe do it if you were super inclined to do it and work super hard at it. But I think that'd be tougher to do without a brand to sort of latch onto. Obviously, you just want to be a little bit selective. I mean, I know you can't really be that selective in who you work for these days in media. Right. It's ideally, it's someone that sort of aligns with your interests and your values, and then you go off and do your own thing. There is that. Now, doing that today within the age of AI worries me a little bit. And that's because I don't know if the equation of people getting their information through AI engines, which is undoubtedly going to rise, is going to be good or bad for that kind of creator. The jury's not out yet. If you think about this, if people start getting their information from Search GPT and Perplexity and these other things, they're just getting an answer and they're not clicking through. That's the conventional wisdom that seems to be holding true with regard to the data we've seen. Generally, traffic to websites is lower. That said, there is data that suggests the traffic that does go through to the sources of that answer, the few people that do click through, is higher quality, which, again, there's always going to be a subset of people for a topic that are really into it. Like maybe I'm into skateboarding and I asked a question about skateboarding and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Oh, this is some new information that I didn't know about skateboarding. I'm going to click through because I hadn't heard of that before because I'm a big enthusiast and I want to engage deeper on this specific thing that I like, as opposed to just getting, a summary of today's news, right? Which everybody gets from what that's the sort of generic use of it. Or I'm just doing a one-off story as a journalist on skateboarding. I'm not an enthusiast. In that case, I might still click through because I'm doing research, but whatever. But the point is there's a subset of people that do want to deeply engage with the topic. And is a summary via AI a good path to reach those people? We really don't know. I'm really excited to learn if it is or isn't, because the biggest thing as a creator, certainly for me, is reach. Like, how do I reach new people? How do I get out there? And, I'm on social and, there's ads, they try to convince you to buy and all this other stuff. So there's all those sort of conventional paths, but I want to sort of arise in sort of in a natural, organic kind of way. Like, what does that look like in the future if it's not just SEO? It's going to be through AI. But maybe it's not a discovery engine. And if it's not, and here's the thing, if the answer comes down, yes, great, AI process my content and I'll get those enthusiastic people, even if I don't get as many clicks. But if it's not, and if that isn't true, then do I just forbid AI from crawling my site? And does that cut me off of the AI world? Do I offer my own chatbot? Like, what's my AI strategy if having AI summaries in a general platform isn't a good way to reach people? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. We all got to figure that out soon.
Yeah. But there's another challenge. You don't have to be a journalist to have a platform now. Everyone has a platform. Right. And we had processes, as Russ was mentioning, in traditional media, there's an accountability, some sort of accountability for independent media against each other. If someone, for example, if media outlet one lies about flood in the north, media outlet B and C will say, no, you're lying. And they were like, sorry, here's a correction. And so before that, there was, even before that report goes, there's an editorial process, right? Sure. Look at my sources and stuff. Now, not only journalists can have their own platform and not have to bother about that, and also anyone. And they're being rewarded by views. They're not being rewarded. I'm saying, I don't see the same accountability mechanism that free platforms for all has for tradition, has in
in contrast with what traditional media had for accountability mechanisms.
Yeah, it's a thorny problem. It has been for a while. AI certainly exacerbates the problem in some ways.
Yeah,
I'm optimistic that it offers a bit of a corrective against broader, I don't call them lies, but just shall we say like alternate perspectives.
Let me deal
with the misinformation one right away, which is that that point about like someone spreads out an outright lie, a faked image, goes out on networks, maybe fools a couple people. I do think the speed of things these days is that does tend to get fact-checked pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying there isn't damage. And certainly if sometimes with some of these deepfakes, the point isn't necessarily to fool people. It's to sort of be violative. So there are also issues around that. That's kind of a separate issue, but it's worth pointing out. So there are definitely issues with content and making sure you can prove it's real or not. There's certain standards that are emerging, particularly with images. Adobe is backing on some of these new standards, and hopefully those will get built into more platforms, and then journalists get trained on them, and then the public at large can check them, so less of that stuff will go viral. So I think there are correctives in that realm, the outright lies realm, that while not perfect, are also scaling. The other issue of the perspectives, and we're here in the sort of a crescendo of our political season, and what that is illustrative of is that both sides accuse the other of misrepresenting what they're saying, and there are contradictions on how each side covers even sort of factual news.
Right.
AI, again, with the big caveat that it's designed to give a complete perspective, can be a bit of a mediator here. And so there's a great app for this. These guys don't pay me, by the way, but it's not very well known because it's a startup, but it's called Ask News. And it's essentially kind of a news search engine programmed to give you more of an overview as opposed to answering a question. So you want to get like, give me the overview on this topic. And it will do exactly what I've sort of was talking about in the ideal, which is like, it gives you a big perspective on that topic, points out it's being covered in contradictory ways, doesn't judge the contradictions, just shows them to you, just highlights them. Like, oh, there's whatever this is. This politician said this, and this is the quote. This side says he was saying this, and this side says he was saying this. We're not here to tell you what he said, but there's the information,
Right.
I don't know if there's a demand for that, right? Because we all want to be in our bubbles, I'm told. But I do see that as a potential corrective, might be too strong here, but at least a sort of umbrella perspective on things that you can turn to when the lies are just kind of taking over and you're not sure what to believe. Again, the huge caveat I made is that it's sort of assuming the AI is designed well, and that requires transparency. That requires like, this is what we, at the very least, some kind of paper, like we're optimizing for this. And it could even be a biased perspective, like that's not what Ask News does, but like you could see a version of that sort of tool that is meant to be partisan, right?
Yeah.
I think that the key is transparency. Like, here's what we're solving for. Here's what we're optimizing for. Here's how we're doing it, to the extent you can show that. There's obviously issues with showing training data and models and whatever. Most places are pretty good, though. I mean, if it's an enterprise tool that isn't a large language model or frontier model creator, they have no interest in that's not proprietary to them. So they should sort of show what their models are and how they're optimizing for accuracy. And if they can do that and it looks and it's, checks out well enough, that's helpful. I think that's progress, and given our sort of polarized environment today.
Yeah.
Wow. So when you, again, I like the preface of saying, hey, this is a well-designed AI. In that situation, it, again, coming out of the season that just ended, I think there was an overwhelming assumption that everyone was lying about everything constantly, always. And you just kind of went through that. And especially with the ads, which that is literally their job, is to position the issue in a way that best represents them. But when you're talking about it like that as an overview in a very sincere way, also giving both of the sides, even if one would identify as alternative facts in that specific idea, I almost feel like that allows us to be more educated than the smoother, cleaner, I watched one news show at 5 o'clock and everyone got the exact same. Like that, I look back at that, I'm like, oh, I wish that was it, because I read an article and I knew everything about it and everything was fine. But I never really questioned those organizations. Like if it was in the Washington Post, right, it was the New York Times, I was like, yep, that's great. All right, awesome. Not saying that we need to question them, but it does allow us to make sure we're holding those sources accountable as well. But that comes with the expectation that you're willing to go on to this startup and trust them and have transparency there and take the time to read all of those and be that way. It feels like it's can be better, but it still comes back to us having to be better as humans and knowing what we're getting into. And if I just want my own echo chamber, I can stay there.
Yeah. Well, again, like I say, this is why it's so important that the designers of these AI platforms are as transparent as they can be and have good goals, which is to say a well-informed public. Because if that's the case, and AI, as I've sort of been kind of evangelizing, it's a friction remover and it's going to be an ever greater part of how people consume information. If all that's true, that means the incentives of AI become the incentives of journalism. And if the AI rewards depth, if the AI rewards accuracy, if the AI rewards showing both sides of an issue, which I'm not trying to say is always the thing to do, but it is. I do also think, you know, this is me kind of opining a bit. I do think the we've gone from showing both sides to, oh, both sides-ism is not always good, to now we're all one-sided all the time, which seemed like a big overcorrection on what we were trying to achieve. And now it's kind of back to, wait a minute, you know, like, I think generally both sides is as a good rule of thumb, while also, you know, giving context around, you know, when there's consensus, right? Yeah, so that's it. And so, like, anyway, it's kind of a bit of a digression on both sides-ism.
No,
but
good.
The point is, you know, like, what is the AI incentivizing? And if it's good journalism, depending on how you define that, then that's good for journalism. Because what AI is mostly doing right now is just increasing efficiency and letting, you know, robots write your headlines and your social copy and, you know, giving you an idea buddy. And all that's great. And the thing is, for the journalists, the few that remain, what are they doing with that extra time? And is it, and what I think, again, this is my view, what I think is super healthy for media is that the incentives are getting away from bite-sized hot takes, which was the thing to do in the social era. And believe me, I know, I was worked at Mashable.
right.
And if now that we're getting away from sort of that idea of everyone reblogging the same story with their, you know, couple of lines of opinion, what replaces that? And my sincere hope is that it's real journalism, real sourcing, real news stories, interesting things that inform and don't just provoke. And again, like the key is the AIs need to incentivize that. And I think they can. We'll see. You know, there's a lot of hangover from the search social era that really needs we need to sort of wake up from before that to really take hold. But we'll see how it goes.
Well, and Pete, that's a really, I really enjoyed the way the what is incentivized. I'm thinking now back on, again, the earlier ages of YouTube, or even still now. I just want to give YouTube and Google a little bit of credit. They are trying to not maybe amplify extreme groups on either side all the time, or yeah, as much as it might have been, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
As much as the algorithm loves to do.
Right. It still is very interested in putting those things out there. But you're saying that was being incentivized if you were full of hate, if you had hot takes that were insane in some scopes, that got elevated and incentivized. And you're saying, hey, maybe we can get back by incentivizing actual, true, deep thought out and well-researched information.
Yeah. And to some extent, you know, it's hard. Social networks, like they made a lot of mistakes, and certainly there was a long period, and we're still in it, where all that provocative content was kind of like what drove audience. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I'm not here to give a whole treatise on Facebook or Meta, but I do think they're very conscious of what content is sort of candy and what content is steak, even though they both sort of fill you up in different ways, or you eat them for different ways. It's not just like, you know, the simplistic view of, oh, engagement, that's all they want. They want more people on the platform and more, I think that they're well beyond that simplistic view, and it's a bit more sophisticated. Certainly they want to make money, but they also want to prioritize long-term health of the platform. I don't know if that necessarily applies to all the platforms. Twitter has certainly been a little weird the last couple of years, though.
No.
There's different forces at work there. A lot of politics, which, you know, that's a whole other podcast.
Especially now, like it, and I'm not like, we'll have to bring you back on, because I think in the next 6 months, specifically X, got it.
Right, yeah.
Is going to be in spotlight in a unpredictable way. That is literally all I can say, is that relationship is going to be unique.
To say too much as state employees, but that would be an interesting.
Yes, so we might have to. I'm giving you an assignment, right? This is university one. You're back in class. Like, keep an eye on that one, because we're going to want your long-term perspective on that.
Got to start my investigation.
But right.
The social incentives were just my point was, the social incentives are very different from AI incentives. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not saying the social incentives are always wrong, but they're incentivizing a certain type of thing. And my general view, it is one of the healthiest things for journalism that they're getting out of the business of news. That's a little bit counterintuitive because as they get out of the business of news, news gets less traffic. But I'm also saying, like, well, was that really audience? You know, this is the whole thing about people who, I was saying earlier, about who want to deeply engage with your brand because they care about the subject. If you're just doing these quick takes that are going viral on social because everyone cares about what, you know, Kim Kardashian or whoever the latest person, it person is saying today, is that really someone you care about? Should you be even optimizing for that? Probably not, I would say. I've seen a lot of media companies, you know, live and die on this kind of viral content.
Oh yeah, or the switch. They're like, less words, more video, or, you know, no videos, pictures. And like, you saw that because of the interactions and that analytics they were getting, and not always was that long-term for the best.
Yeah. And so it's like, I think a good test as a media company or even a content creator, like, are you offering value? Is like, can you do something around this content that would be something that isn't content? You know, something like an event or a webinar.
Oh,
like, if you would do that around the thing you're writing about, then it's probably something you should talk about. If it isn't, then maybe that's just viral junk that you should just ignore. You know,
I like that. That's a good one. That's a good standard to apply.
Yeah, cool. You could steal it.
Good. Yeah. Well, we're gonna send it out. Well, because again, we work with
out in the world,
right? Exactly. We work with students that a lot of them are The interesting thing is, at least with this generation, I would say the majority are some form of content creator, even if it's just a TikTok trend, they are actively participating in it. And I think it's kind of like their lottery. They're like, well, I might as well do this because maybe I'll become TikTok famous. I don't think many of them are counting on it. Like, I don't think it's a true, I have absolutely no data on this. And this is all just my opinion. I want to put it out there.
You are on the ground,
right.
Field experience.
Yeah. Field experience. But I think they're just saying, hey, I might as well put these out there because random people get famous. And if that's 2 months and I make a crap ton of money and it pays for my college, I might as well do it. Just like I might as well pay for a lottery ticket. I know it's probably not going to happen, but I play
lottery ticket. This is free.
That's the next part. So
what do you have to lose? Sometime I was going to be on the social media looking at someone else's anyway.
Exactly. So I might as well participate in it. And I think that's
very interesting.
But it also,
I feel like I should almost write a book on the concept of virality as it applies to content. Yeah. You know, because virality is, in my view, so toxic. Like, it's so addictive. It is when I was at NBC, I was doing a tech blog for them. And this was right when remember dig.com?
Yes.
It was new and it just rose in prominence really quickly. And the reason, like, if you were a publisher or a content creator at the time was that, if you got to the front page of Dig, you got such a traffic spike. And then you just started, like, trying to figure out what the game was, and you would befriend power users on the network, and you would get a whole bunch of your friends to dig up your stuff and try to game it that way. Trust me, I tried all the things, and I was occasionally rewarded with these spikes. But it's like, that's exactly what I'm saying is unhealthy about, like, that's not a content strategy.
No, it's very
that's
unhealthy.
A video
it's
game
horrible,
right?
You know.
Right.
And you're not doing anything that is substantive if you're just trying to, like, take these pinball shots all the time. It's terrible. And, like, social media can do that too. Facebook was horrible for that.
Yeah.
The whole toxicity of virality, I think, is probably kind of an undercover topic. I mean, maybe it is. I don't know. Like, I think people, this is sort of what I'm spouting some conventional wisdom around audience, but just how bad the virality was for, particularly, you had whole brands like Upworthy that I mentioned,
right,
earlier, which was all about virality, and it was a flash in the pan.
Yes,
there's no way. Yes. They tried to build something, but it was a sandcastle because there was no there.
Right. I mean, and the one that I always went for, and it's been interesting to see specifically, is BuzzFeed, and how they were pretty much a click. I would say they were attracting interactions just for the interactions to be able to say that, and now have literally come forward and done some absolutely incredible journalism. And that's where some of the best journalists are out there doing stuff, because BuzzFeed has them on staff, and they can send out random people to investigate very unique niche issues. And they do that. So,
you know, it was funny when CoinDesk won the, I think it was the Loeb Award, one of the prestigious business journalism awards for the reporting on FTX. BuzzFeed News was also an award winner. So we were all there at the dinner together.
Very cool.
And when the BuzzFeed went up to accept their award, they said, well, it's too bad that a lot of people who won this award aren't here anymore. Because, like, there had been the layoffs had already started, and BuzzFeed News had been shut down at that point. But it was it kind of shows you, and that, you know, there's a lot of other issues with media that led to that. But one of the fundamental problems with BuzzFeed, the institution, was that the foundation was built on that virality, right? Even though, like, everything you're saying is correct, BuzzFeed News was legit. BuzzFeed News, it's super talented journalists. They did award-winning journalism, but it was built on this foundation of kind of garbage, frankly.
Yeah,
and ultimately, it collapsed, and it's unfortunate. I'm sure, you know, I'm not sure where all those reporters are. If they haven't been snapped up by other organizations, that's an injustice. But I'm sure they're doing great work somewhere.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. And I think that's where it'll be. But it's just interesting when you start on something like that, and even by the time they started getting recognized, the damage was they had to be cutting back, and it was just that bad timing there. Yeah. Pete, so I know we're running out of time here. So I first want to thank you for being here. I also do want to invite you back because I think we didn't even really get to talk about your AI and your endeavors there. And I also wanted to get into the FTX stuff and that side of stuff. That was incredible. So we're going to have you back because I just want to talk more. And then, like I said, in probably 6 months, we'll have a whole conversation about X and Elon Musk's ability to govern.
Cool. I'm sure we'll all have our government issued X addresses at that point. So
you helped me land that really well. That was perfect. Yes, we're all gonna have our own
X.gov.
Yeah. And then you won't need a social security number anymore. It'll just be an X tag. Okay,
cool. That'd be awesome. Yeah, I'd love to come back.
Awesome. Yeah. Pete, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will talk more, okay?
Cool. Do you mind if I get a quick plug in before I go?
Please. That's what I was just going to do here. Please. Where can we find you? How can we get you? How can we interact with you? How can we follow up?
Come on down to MediaCopilot.ai, where you can check out the AI courses I offer for media professionals, PR professionals, marketers. And you can also subscribe to my newsletter. It's called the Media Copilot. Check it out.
Perfect. We will make sure to do that. And for all of our listeners, I'll have those notes in there where you can directly find Pete and all of the wonderful things he's doing to help support it. So thank you again, Pete.
Thank you. All right,
rock on, you guys.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.